Escape from Midtown. Make a break for the wall or tunnel under. Elementary geometric forms run amok. Architects lay psyche in steel and concrete. Birth of firstborn, bye-bye to mistress, alimony checks. It's all there encoded in columns, the features of facades, windows that will not open. Walk in the shadow of subconscious, toil in the monuments to bitter decline. The skyline grafts the hubris of generations, visible for miles, and inevitably all who see it extract the wrong morals from those stories. Common buildings end too soon. Recognize royalty by height, on sight, and memorize their crowns over time. Some of these buildings arrived by tugboat, towed in from the South Pacific Islands where they were carved from black volcanic rock. These dark glaciers, so much beneath surfaces, in buildings comprised of other buildings' discarded 13th floors, sinister transactions unfold, office space available. Few buildings around here deserve to be people, but judging by the grim procession of faces, some of these folks are halfway to sheetrock, steel-boned, mortar-blooded, granite without end.
Colson Whitehead is the author of the novels The Intuitionist and John Henry Days. His unique, surreal, and often humorous approach to writing informs his work. His latest book is a collection of essays on the Colossus of New York. Welcome to the show, Colson.
Thanks for having me.
Your books seem to be centered around the city of New York. Let's talk about New York for a minute. In The Intuitionist, you carefully conceal the identity of New York. It's masked. It's anonymous. Why?
I think I was trying to get at the essential nature of cities, and so while the city in the book does read as New York, I wanted to just make this sort of unnamed place that you could project your various ideas of the city upon. So and at the same time, I was reaching back to film noir conventions and the detective story conventions, and so there's a lot of sort of, foggy streets and shadowy doorways. And I think it sort of adds to, the sort of anonymous nature of the city where each person is creating those kind of details on their own to form this metropolis. So it's unnamed, and I think for good reason.
Could you tell us a little bit, our listeners, a little bit about the story that you tell in The Intuitionist?
Well, The Intuitionist, as unlikely as it may be, is about two warring groups of elevator inspectors. The old hands, the empiricists, do it the right way, checking for wear and tear and the sort of things you'd want elevator inspectors to look for. And the new insurgent wing of the Elevator Inspectors Guild is made up of the intuitionists who can just step into an elevator in question and divine what's wrong with the machine. So it's an election year, and each side is trying to get their candidate to win. And into that sort of intrigue, I throw Lila Mae Watson, who's the first black woman to become an elevator inspector. And an elevator crashes on her watch, and she's sort of drawn into various intrigues and has to solve this, sort of fake detective story of who what caused the crash in the machine.
Could you tell us a little bit about why you chose a sort of detective novel format to tell this story?
Well, I tried to write a novel a couple years before that, and it was pretty terrible. No one liked it. And really, I just wanted to learn about plot. The conventions and stock characters of the detective novel seem like a good jumping-off point to learn about plot. They're very, the things you expect in a detective novel, reversals, forward progression, there's a search quest. And it seemed like, I could use these conventions to teach me about plot and suspense and moving a linear narrative forward, and at the same time provide a kind of scaffolding for various kind of jokes and a parody of detective stories at the same time.
You really enjoy humor, and your books are very funny. How did you bring humor into the story of warring elevator inspectors?
Well, the idea is so absurd that immediately it's humorous. And the idea, and the problem in making that kind of story real, is that I guess what you have to do is present this absurd idea in a realistic way to keep people interested, or else it's just a farce. And the various other things I'm talking about, race and politics, are not going to be taken seriously. So the humor becomes very deadpan, you know, and I'm kind of winking a lot of the time when I'm talking about elevator slang and the debased treatment of the escalator inspector in the elevator guild, and the various sort of absurd little rituals that they go through, and I guess the point is to make this ridiculous idea a little more real by making these kind of jokes, and also I just have a sort of cockeyed view of the world, and that always creeps in. So,
One of the things I really enjoyed about this book was the way you created a literature and a world. It was almost, in many ways, a science fictional novel because of the way you talked about the technology and the way you created this world of the elevator inspectors within which to launch your themes of race and politics.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was consciously trying to use the tools of science fiction. Samuel Delaney has this great essay about how language works differently in a science fiction tale. And if in the first paragraph you come across a sentence that goes, "The door dilates," well, what does that mean? You know, we have to figure out that in this world, the science fiction world, doors dilate, you know, and open and close that way. And so you teach the reader how to read the book as they're going along. You teach them the rules of the world. So when I realized I was sort of in trouble by having an elevator inspector solve a criminal case, I had to make up a set of skills for the elevator inspector. And that meant making a school. And if there's a school, then there's probably academic infighting. And that gave birth to the empiricists and the intuitionists. And if there's a workplace, then there's office politics. And that sort of fed into the kind of Republican, Democratic wings that are fighting in the elevator guild. And so in trying to make this ridiculous idea real, that elevator inspectors are important and our heroes in the city, I was forced to create slang and culture and a way of speaking, a way of dressing, and you know the complete codes of their behavior.
Once you've created this world, you do quite a bit of really interesting ways of working in talking about race and politics within this world, because your main character, Lila May, is the first black and female inspector in the world of these elevator inspectors.
Yeah, I guess the more you think about something, at least with me anyway, the more sort of meanings and weird shadings develop. So just the word elevate, you know, has so many different meanings. You know, the phrase uplift the race kind of suggests itself as a possible theme. And then there's literal elevation, going up floors in a building. There's spiritual elevation. Then an elevator becomes something that elevates, becomes a way of you know, reaching transcendence. So as the book, you know, progressed, these different meanings, you know, suggested themselves and became fruitful avenues to talk about these different things, whether it was social uplift, racial uplift, spirituality.
Could you tell us why you chose the world of elevator inspectors to talk about race?
Well, you know, it's totally, you see, I can't help laughing because it is ridiculous. And so the problem, again, is how do you make this? How do you say that with a straight face? And really, I was just trying to do a parody of a detective novel and use these detective novel characters of the henchmen, the mob boss, the crooked politician, to teach myself about plot. And I was watching a news show, 2020, and they had a little piece on the hidden dangers of escalators. And I guess over time, the tread can sort of depart from the side of the track. And little people, you know, children, people with little feet can get their, you know, toes ripped off. And then they interviewed an escalator inspector. And I thought, wow, that's such a weird job. You don't think about it. But I guess somebody has to inspect the escalators. And from there, from growing up in the city, the elevator inspector has always been this anonymous hero. He comes in when you go to work or school, and he signs his name on the inspection certificate, but you don't know anything about him. One year he's using black ink, one year he's using blue. Like, why is that? And then they have certain beats so that you can go to your friend's apartment, and the same guy has been there, And so I thought it'd be funny just to have an elevator inspector become an inspector. And I went to the library to see what sort of skills an elevator inspector would bring to a criminal case. And of course, there were none, because they're just elevator inspectors. And that's where I decided to make the whole thing about elevators and elevator intrigue, and started creating that kind of cultural lore of elevators.
Lila May is a very interesting female character. She's strong and headstrong, but she's also very quiet and seems to exist within herself.
Yeah, she's a very internal character, repressed in many different ways, which I think is why when I was thinking of my next book, What to Do, I really wanted to have like a lot of different characters and a lot of different voices, because it is kind of grueling to stay with that sort of character for a long time. Since you know the book isn't particularly upbeat, you're also just hanging out with a very depressed person who you keep putting obstacles in front of. And so I always feel like when I go from book to book, the one I'm doing now is an antidote to the one before. So it was nice in John Henry Days to have a much broader canvas and a nice multitude of voices instead of sort of Lila May's.
Let's talk about John Henry Days, because that's just a fascinating idea. I love the idea. I think I read where you mentioned the idea of John Henry in a search engine when you first started looking for him.
Yeah, but I mean, I had always really liked the story, and I kind of knew, from college on that one day I'd have to write about him in some way. And I was working at a computer company in San Francisco. They were trying to make a rival portal to Yahoo, and they're basically hiring people off the boat. I moved here and had a job like in a week. There's a lot of downtime, it was kind of definitely overstaffed, and I haven't really had a lot of time to kill. So I put John Henry into his search engine, and the first thing that came up was I think Kasparov's battle with Big Blue, the chess computer. I'm not sure if that's the right chess player, but it was the first time a chess master had been beaten by a computer. And so the comparison they made was to John Henry beating the steam drill. And that sort of got me going on this idea of updating this industrial age anxiety tale, John Henry beating the steam drill, for the information age, and to sort of talk about our wrestling with technology now and how it's different or the same as back in the 1870s when John Henry supposedly was working.
You really had a chance to indulge your interest in speaking in other voices in this novel. You created, it's almost like literary pointillism in some ways. There's so many little asides and different characters who come in. Could you talk about how and why you did that?
Well, I mean, I was very concerned with plot and The Intuitionist. And for me, John Henry Days has a thematic plot, and that's the development of this idea of John Henry, so that he means different things to different people, different times, different cultures, so that there's one John Henry for railroad workers in the 1880s. There's another for a blues singer in the 1930s who's singing the song. He's something else for Paul Robeson, who starred in the short-lived John Henry the Musical in the 1940s. For socialists in the 40s and 50s, he was a real working-class hero. There's no sort of question of whether his battle with the steam drill was out of excessive pride or was a failure. There's no ambiguity. For them, he was striking a blow against the man and for all people who are sort of ground up by the machine. And it means something different for me, someone growing up in the end of the 20th century, who obviously wasn't working on a chain gang like John Henry, and has I have my own sort of battles, and so each different character who I bring in has a different point of view of John Henry, and I think it adds up to a kind of cubist portrait of him. You see him from a lot of different angles. And over time, instead of having a straightforward plot that goes A to B, B to C, It sort of moves along by these different conceptions of John Henry, and that's a kind of, I guess, what I call a thematic plot.
Your plot then is your presentation of the evolving vision of John Henry from his original inception to now in the information age.
Yeah, it's kind of an argument I'm making over time over about what he means and what he continues to mean, because his meaning, he's very elusive. I think his meaning keeps, you know, shifting.
Now, this book also had a much more autobiographical trend, didn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the main character is a hack journalist and who is called to Talcott, West Virginia, to write about the John Henry Days Festival. And, you know, for many years, I was a critic at the Village Voice in New York. And when the web boom started, it seemed like, you know, you could not get a job writing something for the web, whether it was, you know, film reviews, movie reviews. Everyone was trying to get these databases up and running, and they needed money. And instead of writing, it was called content, you know. And so immediately your sort of vocation has, you know, has become debased in this kind of new language of new media. And when I came out here, I'd finished The Intuitionist and was, you know, trying to pay off debts that I incurred by writing it, because well, I wasn't working that much because I was trying to write, and I, you know, got this job at this computer company who, I don't know, did I mention the name already? I'm not sure.
I don't wanna...
That's,
you haven't mentioned the name.
It was my job to write these 40-word blurbs for weekly web chats. So if you were going to pets.com, I would write, you know, cuckoo for your cockatoo, you know, crazy for your chihuahua, come to pets.com every week at 8 o'clock for a pet chat. And I just felt, you know, after writing, after being a working journalist and finishing, you know, a novel, that I've been sort of, I was being sort of beaten down by the man. So I think that definitely fed into some of the more satirical parts about the information age in the book.
One of the things that's difficult to do is for a writer to write about writing without a masturbatory feel. How did you achieve that? Because it's just as funny.
Oh, well, because, I mean, the you know, the characters, these, I call them the junketeers, or these hack journalists who get flown everywhere by movie studios and sort of airline magazines and cover whatever item, you know, they're hard to write. There's, you know, they are so debased, and they really are this kind of cranky, cynical bunch of characters that writing becomes, you know, a very not very glamorous profession. It's sort of, I mean, it becomes digging ditches the way they're doing it, and they become sort of ironic counterpoints to the pick and shovel men of the railroads. Instead of, you know, hacking out bits of rock to drive a tunnel through a mountain, they're hacking out column inches to feed, you know, the media machine. So it's very unglamorous and not, and it doesn't come off very well in the book.
You like to write about humanity trapped within machinery.
I tend to personify inanimate objects a lot. I'm not really sure why. A lot of that goes on in Colossus. Buildings have attitudes and streets have personalities. And at least in the new book, you know, I am trying to break down the barriers between us and the city. I think there's a way that we look after the city and the city looks after us. And that means that it has, you know, some human qualities and, you know, has a certain, it can be a punitive parent. It can be a loving confidant. So I think I just it comes to me very naturally. So, you know, I think definitely with this book, I went with it. And in terms of talking about technology, I've just always been very interested in it. You know, I read a lot of science fiction and comic books as a kid. So with John Henry, and I think The Intuitionist also, from watching all these cautionary tales about nuclear war and machines running amok in the 70s, that was like the golden age of, you know, of the computer that becomes sentient and takes over the world and everybody dies.
Well, there's a very famous science fiction novel from the 70s that is the only other novel that I can remember with the word Colossus in its title, which is Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but I saw the movie at a very young age.
Yes.
And actually, I bought a poster of it on eBay a couple months ago, because it's the word Colossus has always had a certain power for me, because As a kid, when I was seeing that movie, had no idea what a Colossus was. I just know it's sort of powerful and you know, it's out to get you. The title of the book, The Colossus of New York, comes from a 1950 science fiction movie. It's a really bad movie about a Nobel Prize winning scientist who was in a car accident, and then his scientist father implants his brain into a robot called the Colossus, and the various hijinks ensue. And he goes around, haunting New York. And I had a book of science fiction and horror stories, and I had a picture of the Colossus in it. So I didn't know what the Colossus of New York was, but I knew it was definitely bigger than you and could knock you around. And so that's sort of what happened to a lot of the people in the book, and seemed to be a good title.
The new book is a fascinating book because as you read it, you're going to find it typically in the nonfiction section. But as you read it, it doesn't read like nonfiction, but it is. You really water down that barrier between fiction and nonfiction. I find it really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what to call it. It's not fiction because I feel like there's a lot of observational research that goes into it. It's not strictly nonfiction because there's a lot of speculation and made-up stuff that's in it. And it just seemed like the essay, just the word essay, from the French, to try, to make an attempt, seemed to be what I was doing. I'm trying to get at something. And it might not fall into traditional categories, but what are you going to do? What are you going to do? I mean, when the first thing my publisher said when they got the book was, excuse me, what do you put on the ISBN number? Does it go into the belles lettres section or memoir essay? It's hard to pin down.
One of the things that I struck me when reading it was that it wouldn't be too hard to have turned this book into a book of poetry. If you just hit a line break it after every sentence, bang, you've got a book of poetry.
Right. The fiction writer in me, gets really upset when people say it's very poetic. I'm a fiction nationalist. But, a lot of it does jump from idea to idea. And sometimes I'm following a linear thought. Sometimes I'm moving forward because it rhymes, because I'm making an obscure pun. Some of the sentences are very imagistic. Some of them are crammed with gritty detail. And so, I am using some of the techniques of poetry in this book. I think it's always funny the response I get because fiction writers say, that's not nonfiction because you're having too much fun and you're putting too much fictional elements into it. And nonfiction people think that it's not nonfiction because it has too much fiction in it. And then the poets are just glad to have anybody hang out with them. So they want to claim it as their own, as a prose poem.
Now, you say you're a fiction nationalist. Why?
Oh, I just identify, I still see myself as mostly a novelist and a fiction writer. So, but really, no matter what form you're working in, it's just, you're just using different tools to get at something, some sort of truth. Sorry, in a poem or in journalism, you're using words to get at, the world. And so I don't see the distinctions between fiction and nonfiction as being that important.
Could you talk a bit about your work as a media critic, TV? It sounds like it'd be quite fun.
It was a real blast. I mean, I grew up in Manhattan and read The Village Voice and always thought it was really cool to be one of those guys who talks about hip-hop one day and then, like, Derrida the next, you wear two different hats. And when I started working at The Voice, that was very popular, that sort of using the tools of high culture to talk about low culture. So I started working in the book section. It was my job to open all the books that came to the office every day. And that was we'd get like 40 books a day in, and we only reviewed 40 books a month. So it was a real sort of harsh introduction to the real world of book reviewing and sort of the plight of the author. But, it's called a writer's paper, so which can be good and bad. You can have a lot more free rein, but you can be self-indulgent at times. So I learned you know, what to do and what not to do in terms of writing. If you write a good article, people, you know, say, hey, Cole, you know, great article, you know, it's really funny. If you write a bad article, it's like a total dud and no one says anything. So you know you've screwed up and maybe you went a little over the top and maybe you shouldn't have I in every sentence and maybe talk about the thing itself.
It's one of the things that's fun is TV is really fun to make fun of. And you spent some time writing about TV. Tell us about that and about that world.
Well, yeah, I was a TV critic for 2 years, and it was great just to have that kind of forum, you know, that column. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good TV, so you just end up panning everything, which, you know, gets to be tedious, and which is why I finally quit. But it was a way, you can talk about, everything's on TV, so you can talk about everything. I had a really fun article where I just talked about the weather, because I just talked about weathermen, and then I started talking about the weather for, like, you know, three paragraphs. And it was just kind of a fun kind of riff on Al Roker. I mean, I visited all the corporate headquarters of ABC, NBC, and CBS and talked about how their architecture reflected their prime time fortunes. And so, like, the kind of crammed architecture of the ABC schedule reflected their sort of haphazard idea of, like, what sitcoms to put on. And so it became, like, more of a humor column towards the end where I just sort of, like, indulge my weird ideas about the city and pop culture. But I did have to quit because, you know, for every Sopranos, there's 30 sitcoms about mismatched roommates. And it gets, you can't make the same joke over and over again. It's just sort of, you know, just for your own sanity, you have to move on.
Could you talk a little bit about your interest in genre fiction? From Stephen King to science fiction to Jonathan Lethem.
Well, as a child, that's what I read. You know, as my first sort of exposure to literature, and I remember reading Carrie like in seventh grade and thinking like, you can just stay home and write about like bloody massacres in high school and get paid. That's like a good job. And most of my friends who write now were comic book geeks, and so you either wanted to write the X-Men or like, draw the X-Men, and that was where your first sort of creative impulses, you know, were fed. I guess ghetto-wise, detective fiction or science fiction, I don't read that much anymore.
Who do you read?
Who do I read? I read a lot of nonfiction. That's where I get a lot of ideas from. So when I'm down, I'll, you know, when I have some downtime and storing up energy, I'll pick up some weird microhistory of like the pencil or something, and that ends up being an idea later on. I had a fun time this spring teaching at the University of Houston, and I decided to teach a contemporary fiction class. So I really caught up on all the people I hadn't read in the last couple of years. So I read The Interpreter of Maladies and Boned Up on Sherman Alexie, all these sort of contemporary fiction writers who I hadn't gotten around to. And it was really great to know that and see that there are people who are doing, you know, great stuff and who are sort of working at some of the same problems you are from different angles.
One of the things that interests me is the aspects of fantasy in your work. Not fantasy as in elves and dwarves, but fantasy as in the imagination and the projection of the imagination upon the world and how that controls how we see.
Well, I think I'm a very strange guy, and I think when I look at a subway car, I see this, you know, very strange kind of dance of humanity. And I think since I have the luxury of working at home and having a lot of free time, I can indulge that, I think, in my writing. What was really liberating about these essays is that I could be a lot more surreal than I, you know, could be in my fiction because there were no rules. I mean, in The Intuitionist, I have to make a case for these elevator inspectors as real people, and I have to explain how this absurd occupation works. Whereas in the essays, I can have these sort of great non sequiturs that are, you know, I find really amusing, and add a little sort of touch of the bizarre to the story of, you know, these different New York places. So the book was just really fun to sort of fun in that it allowed me to indulge my sort of sense of the bizarre.
As you were creating the Colossus of New York, did you move around and actually live in the different parts of the city?
I've moved around enough. I think I've moved about 12 times in my lifetime in New York City. So that, you know, the Broadway chapter is informed from living up in Harlem and having that kind of Broadway, and then living downtown and having a kind of hip downtown Broadway. Some of the chapters I didn't do any, you know, so-called research. You know, I like the Port Authority chapter takes off from the idea of how people get into the city, but it's really about how people arrive in their new hometowns, whether it's San Francisco or Chicago. You're generally coming, arriving, you know, kind of broke, perhaps on a Greyhound, and it's about what we expect of our new home and the kind of dreams we're heaping upon it, which are immediately dashed when we get out of the train station or subway station and have no idea like where to go. Other chapters, like the Central Park chapter, I ended up doing some personal archaeology and going back to the places I went to as a kid, that park or this park, and trying to figure out what they meant to be then, what they mean to me now. I live in Brooklyn, so I don't get up to Central Park that often. So it was a real journey to be reminded of what it means to me, even though I take it for granted. In the same way that I took the Twin Towers for granted, you kind of assume they'd always be there. And now that you kind of see that no matter how big it is, it might disappear one day. You have to kind of renegotiate how you feel about these things. So a lot of that was going on as I was walking around taking notes.
I was impressed that there was no post 9/11 commentary in the book at all.
No, I think when we think about New York, it's in the background. So there's no reason to go into it. I mean, I think there's a sentence here and a sentence there that maybe alludes to calamity or evanescence. And definitely, I wrote some of the essays before 9/11 and the bulk of them afterwards. And there is a kind of sort of deep sadness that informs some of the later essays here and there. But, it's that was an event 2 years ago. And I think it's enough that it's the shadow of it is already so much over the book that to even like mention it is going over the top.
I was really impressed with the language in this book. It's mind-bogglingly beautiful. It's funny. It's just a joy to read. Could you tell us about how you crafted this? Was this something that you just sat down, wrote out longhand, that was it, turned it in? Or was it infinitely revised?
Pretty infinitely revised. And actually, I think three more clauses I want to put in these different chapters. Maybe for a paperback, I'll put them in there. I got the idea for the form from a chapter in John Henry Days. I call it the Country Fair chapter, and it was my attempt to link the fair in John Henry Days in Talcott, West Virginia, to all fairs. There are certain universal events common to fairs or parades. The texture of cotton candy, sort of watching a balloon swim up into the air, the sort of tentative steps you take as you step off the tilt-a-whirl. So I was trying to, get all these universal feelings and cram them into one brief chapter about fairs. And I felt the voice in that chapter pans out, zooms in, hops from person to person, captures a moment of joy, and then switches to the next person who's standing next to that person. Who's having a bad day. And it seemed that that voice is very fruitful, and I kept thinking about it. And once I was done with John Henry, I started writing these brief essays. I started with the Port Authority chapter, I wrote the Rain chapter. And it just seemed like a really kind of great new form. When I started working on it wholeheartedly, I would just write down, if I had an idea about the subway, I'd write it down and maybe put it in the computer file. And for a year and a half, it'd be like one line in the computer file, in the subway chapter file. And then I get a rush of inspiration and in a week, finish it, revise it. Some things I might have an idea for the Times Square chapter. I might assemble it line by line for 2 years. Some weeks I wrote nothing. Some months I wrote nothing. So it really was just assembling these different impressions and sensations and speculations over time, and then tweaking them and trying to find the rhythm of, you know, each sentence and paragraph, until, you know, for me they were clockwork. It was very frustrating when I knew a chapter was 99% done, but there was like a word out of place, but you don't know what word it is, and then suddenly you realize, oh, maybe this sentence goes at the end of this paragraph, and you're like, okay, I'm done. You know, it was a real, there's a real way that it was very jigsaw and had to be, I think, sort of perfectly fit together.
Could you talk about trying to sell this book? It seems like having written two highly acclaimed novels, walking up to your agent saying, I'm doing a book of essays, is not going to put a smile on their face.
Right. I mean, I wrote four of the essays before 9/11, and I sent them to my agent, and she's like, good, you know, how's the novel going? You know, she's very supportive, but, you know, obviously it is, you know, a tougher sell. For me as an artist, I knew I was a novelist, and I knew I could write a novel. You know, you might not like my fiction, but at least they fit the description, and, you know, they seem to do okay. So I made Colossus a side project and worked on, you know, wrote half of a novel, and that was very good. But after 9/11, it really seemed that I should be working on this book. I was writing essays for the New York Times about the city in the aftermath, and they're really hard to write and really painful and personal in a way I hadn't really allowed myself to be before. So it seemed I should go full speed ahead, and I think the nature of the city, the culture and feeling of the city had changed so much from, you know, the publisher of Random House to the guy on the street. So, we all wanted some sort of expression of how we live in the city and what it means to us. And so once I showed the publisher the four essays, it was a tough pitch before they saw them, but then once they saw them, it made sense, and they were, you know, they've been supportive, you know, through the whole thing.
Well, I can understand why, because having read it myself, it's so full of joy, and you mentioned this word a lot, rhythm. Talk about the musical influences of your writing. Are there any? Or the film influences, because at one point you were talking about cameras zooming around.
Yeah, I think that those Passos narrative voice of the camera eye was really important to me when I was in college, and in it, it's in his USA trilogy and a bit in Manhattan Transfer, but he'll take a character, real or fictional, and just bounce around in their head, sort of zooming from idea to idea, and it's kind of hard to follow. You sort of get into the rhythm, eventually, and when I first encountered that, when I was, you know, discovering what I liked about fiction, it just had a really big influence on me. So I was using, for me, it's kind of reined in a bit more than Dos Passos does, and I'm trying to give the reader something more to hold on to. But, you know, it moves from idea to pun. I mean, sounds are just really, really important in this book. And I think I was trying to kind of capture the welter of a street corner or a subway car. There are, you know, 20 people on a street corner. They're all thinking different thoughts. They're all in different places. Some have had good days. Some have had bad days. And trying to, you know, capture that that calamity that exists on a street corner or in an elevator or in a city bus, I think just produced this. Musical voice and cadence.
You don't address some of the things that you address in your first two books, particularly in your new book. Matters of race and politics seem to be left behind in the impressions of the city.
I think, you know, there are no, like, real names, and no first names. There's no references to race, except on a beach, and that's about how some people are tanning faster than other people. Because I think those are more, I think, superficial qualities to, you know, to people, I think, in terms of what I was trying to get at. If I'm trying to talk about how we actually live and how we actually feel about things, whether it's mundane, how to get a seat on a subway car, or a little more profound, how can I live this life in the city? I think if you're talking about skin color, that's sort of like, it's not actually that important and didn't really occur to me when I was writing the book. I guess I get asked about it now because it has been a really fruitful topic for me in the past and will be in the future, but didn't seem appropriate to sort of getting beneath the skin of the city in this book.
Could you tell us about your new novel?
I would if I didn't think it would jinx me. I put it down for 2 years to work on Colossus, and that's the longest I've ever put something down. So I'm quickly running out of procrastination devices. I mean, I'm out here talking about Colossus, and that's a way of not working. So in a couple of weeks, I'll have to get back to work, and I'm sure it'll go well because I like the book, but I'm being a little superstitious.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about superstitions. I share those superstitions myself. I'm loath to mention anything that I'm doing until it's actually done.
Right. I mean, I'm not one of these writers who has to have, like, you know, their pencils and just sharpened at a certain length and have a certain kind of desk and write with a certain kind of pad. When I put all my notebooks in a pile up from the last 10 years, some are pocket size, some are, you know, legal pads, and they all are filled with this kind of crabbed writing. I think the only, in terms of jinxes, I guess the older I get and the more I produce, I sort of wonder, you know, was that my last good idea? Like, I'm really proud of this book. I'm like, can I write another good book? I mean, I don't know. I think that book was kind of good. I'm really proud of it. So I think I am getting a little more superstitious and wary of jinxes just because I feel, I like what I've done, and I hope it can continue. I don't end up turning out like The Intuitionist 2, The Return of Lila May, you know, and start running out of ideas.
Well, it's also part of the writing process itself is to keep that energy bottled up.
Yeah, I mean, between books, I definitely, you know, veg hard and break out the TiVo and try to think about as little as possible and just sort of get back in touch with my friends who I weren't talking to because I was working so hard. So, but that time is very, you know, it's very important. It's where you sort of ideas germinate and you kind of gather your energies for the next project.
We've been speaking with Colson Whitehead. His latest book is a selection of essays called The Colossus of New York. Thank you, Colson.
Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.